Okay, Erev Tov. This is Rabbi Liebtag's hour usually, right? So, big group this year, wow. Okay, my name is Jeffrey Wolf. I am a professor of history and the history of halakha in the Talmud department at Bar Ilan. I am an unofficial member of the staff. In other words, I learn 2-3 times a week in the Beis Medrash and as an sort of a token of my esteem and gratitude for being able to sit in such an august Beis Medrash, I agreed to fill in when various members of the faculty go off on their various recruiting and otherwise types of trips. It gives me an opportunity to get out of the ivory tower and to teach what I usually teach, not so much only as academics, but also as Torah. So that's why we're here. What I aim to do in the course of the year, we should have enough sessions, is to introduce you to another side of the lives and writings of the people who you, in whose world you're immersed willy-nilly by being in Meis Medrash. What Eli calls the world of the Rishonim has taken various different types of forms over the years. This is not the first year I've taught the Chutznikim in the Gush. This year we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to cover similar ground, but from a different angle. What I want to do is to focus on four specific groups of Rishonim who whose writings you encounter every day, but whose the context of whose lives and the type of differences between the schools that they represent, we often don't pay attention to. In particular, we're going to talk about the Gaonim. That's what we're going to start talking about today. Then we'll move over to Rishonei Sfarad HaRishonim. There are Rishonei HaRishonim and Rishonei Achronim. Rishonei HaRishonim are those Sephardic Rishonim who lived at the time of the Muslim conquest and rule in Spain, up until approximately the 12th century. Then we'll talk about Rishonei Ashkenaz, which is the period before Rashi, including Rashi and Balei HaTosfos. And then, hopefully, towards the end of the year, we will get to Achronei Rishonei Sfarad, those Rishonim who lived in the time of the majority Christian rule of Spain, from approximately the 12th century or the 13th century, up until the expulsion in 1492. So, it's a lot on our plate. I hope we can manage to do it. I hope that the other members of your faculty travel more. So this way we'll maybe finally get to the final terminus. And, so that roughly is what we're going to be doing. Thing is, I don't think I have sheets. So if I can borrow, thank you. You want your share. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the Gaonim. When we talk about Gaonei Bavel, we're talking about a period of time which runs approximately from the year 500, 550 until, the traditional end point of the Gaonic period is 1038. Why 1038? In 1038, the last of the Gaonim that is recognized as such, Rav Hai Gaon, passed away. And generally, that's considered to be like the end of the period. The yeshivot in Bavel kept functioning. We're going to encounter a few people who actually functioned in Bavel afterwards. But from a qualitative point of view, it's accepted both historically and it's one of these wonderful cases where the academics and the Rabbanim agree. So here, everybody agrees that Rav Hai Gaon marks the end, really the end of an era. In terms of location, we're talking about a very unique situation in which 95% of the Jewish people live under one government. Okay. That government is based in Baghdad, in Baghdad. We're talking about the Abbasid Caliphate, which rules an empire that reaches from the northernmost part of Spain. It's Spain itself, Christian Spain, is just a little strip of countries in the northern shore. The rest is ruled by the Muslims. The Muslim world reaches from Spain all the way to China. And a little bit later, it will in fact a couple of hundred years later will in fact include include India. As we will see, this changes a little bit around the year 750, because at that point, you don't have to remember all these things, but around the year 750, Spanish element of the Muslim world becomes independent and sets itself up as a separate caliphate. That's going to be important later when we talk about Spain, when we talk about Sephardic Rishonim. But for our purposes, in the, most of the period that we under which we're discussing, culturally and economically, and for a significant part of the time politically, 95% of the Jews in the world live within the Muslim orbit. The number of Jews who we will call Ashkenazim or even proto-Ashkenazim is minuscule. In fact, I don't think I'm stretching it if I say that there were more Jews in Gush Etzion than there were Ashkenazim. Okay? In fact, I am not stretching it. There's no question that there are more Jews in Gush Etzion than there were proto-Ashkenazim. Ashkenazim don't begin to develop until like the 9th century, well into the Gaonic period, and then you're talking about teeny-weeny communities, which are really insignificant from a demographic point of view, even though from a, you know, from a Torah point of view, they were they're tremendously creative. Okay. What does it mean? What does that mean that all the Jews live under one government from a Jewish point of view? Okay, from the point of view of the government, they all pay taxes to the same address. That's important. What's important is because for the last, I mean, I'm trying to think if there's another precedent. No, I don't think so. For the last time, all Jews in the world more or less look to one center of Torah scholarship for guidance. And that is the two yeshivot in Baghdad. Well, first they're in the original places, then they're in Baghdad, the yeshivot of Sura and Pumbedita. Sura and Pumbedita are cities where the yeshivot were founded. Sura was founded by Rav, it's the same yeshiva. Pumbedita was founded by Shmuel, actually, Pumbedita is not where it really started. He really started in Nahardea and it went back and forth, but they switched the names. Eventually they find themselves in Baghdad because Baghdad's the big city. New York, it's Yerushalayim, whatever the case might be. They find that the yeshivot move there because that's where the action is, and as we'll see, it fits their other jobs within the broader Jewish community. The Muslims give the Geonim, and more importantly, the head of the Jewish community within this huge empire, the Rosh Kola, total autonomy to run their own lives according to the Torah. All the Muslims are interested in is two things. First, they're interested in taxes. Two, they're interested that the Jews run their lives and behave according to the laws of Islam, as promulgated in the Pact of Omar, which means that Jews are allowed to be secure in their lives and their property and their religion on condition that they are kept in very clearly second-class status and blatantly inferior to Muslims. That's all they care about. Everything else, what the Jews do themselves, they couldn't care. Same kind of autonomy is given, by the way, to Christians. It's a matter of a principle in which, by the way, the Muslims are more or less continuing the tradition of communal autonomy that the Jews had under the Persians, all the way back to Cyrus, the truth of the matter is. Okay? Now. Yes?
In the other places, we were considered different, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? We were treated, besides, like, just the second flat, status of being in class, you did have to walk, like, in the gutters as opposed to on the streets.
Okay, that's correct. That's correct. I said, I'm not going into the whole case of the Dhimmi. The protected minorities under Islam had to be blatantly in second class. How extreme and how precisely those rules were applied varied from place to place. There was a certain amount of a stretch. There were limits. But, you know, in it's pretty clear that in Baghdad under the Abbasids, things were a little looser. In Morocco, they were not at all loose. They were very, very strictly enforced. By the way, one of the general rules, one of the things people like to say is that Jewish life under Christians was much harder than under Islam. I'd say, you know, pogrom for pogrom, that's probably true. However, it is also a fact that whenever Jews failed to live up to or to live within the restrictions of the Dhimma, of the Pact of Omar, that was usually cause for pogroms. And in fact, the increase in anti-Jewish activity in the Muslim world, which can be easily traced to the 19th century, happens at the exact same time as emancipation and sort of a shaking of the bonds begins to characterize Jewish life in the Muslim world. The Muslims see that as by the way, I'm being very careful. I'm not saying Arabs because not every Muslim is an Arab. Is taken as a rejection of God's rule for Jews, and therefore the result is usually violence. It's one of the reasons why it's not at the moment, best of my knowledge. There is no mechanism for any self-respecting Muslim country to make full peace or recognize on a principle level the existence of the state of Israel. How we have peace with Egypt and Jordan is another story. It's not for now. In any event, the Jews have autonomy, and the center of religious authority is found in the yeshivot and the Rosh Kula. Okay. Now, that's an amazing thing. That's an amazing thing. Because starting around 550, this is the period when the Bavli, when the Gemara is finally redacted, it's not written. It's not written. I mean, people have, you know, like crib notes and stuff like that. But in general, it's not written. But the Gemara is finalized. And one of the things that the Gaonim take upon themselves is to make sure that the Gemara is, that the Bavli is spread throughout the world as the final statement of the Masorah of Torah Shebaal Peh. Okay. Now, in this, they encounter some competition from, anybody guess? Eretz Yisrael. First of all, not Yerushalayim. Because the Jewish community, first of all, because the center of scholarship for in Eretz Yisrael was not in the south. It was in the Galil. In fact, the Rishonim, for example, is finished 100 years before the Bavli, around the year 400, in the Galil. In fact, there's this lovely thing that just started. About a year ago, called Shvil HaSanhedrin. You can actually go, there's an app where you can go from place to place to place to place, where every place, all the places where the Sanhedrin was, including places where there wasn't really a Sanhedrin, but it was Bez Din HaGadol, Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael. It made it all the way to Katsrin. If you go to Katsrin, to the museum in Katsrin, you'll see they have the, the lintel of Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael that they found from the 12th century when it was in the Golan, and then eventually went to Damascus and so on. There was competition between the center and Eretz Israel, between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. And in fact, the Gaonim worked very, very hard to make sure that the Bavli won out over the Yerushalmi. But it was not a long protracted effort. At the end of the day, as I said, it was pretty clear that for all kinds of reasons, both political and qualitative, that the Bavli was going to become the superior source of authority. As the Rif says at the end of Erevin, look it. I mean, even according to the rules of Halacha Kebasroi, that the Chachmei Bavel knew everything in Yerushalmi. They had all the Masorot of Eretz Israel. They evaluated them. What they accepted. What they didn't, they didn't. And therefore, we paskin Halacha Kebasroi. We follow the later opinion, because you can always look a little further when you come a little bit later. Okay, now, so that their first task was to spread the Bavli, and now you've got a situation in which 95% of the Jews are under the Gaonim. I mean, it's perfect. It could have been planned better, because all of the dayanim and all of the teachers and all of the texts, everything goes from Baghdad out. So the Gaonim see themselves, okay? The Gaonim see themselves as the representatives of the authoritative Torah Shebaal Peh, because they have the Yerushalmi, they have the Bavli, and they have all the Torot of the Amoraim, and they are the ones who know exactly what the words mean, and they can interpret the sole source of how to interpret the Gemara. So they're like it. And they present a very, very centralized vision of learning, authority, psak, people write to them. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. People write to them from all over the world, and they view themselves as we're it. Okay. Interestingly, by the way, up until in the period of the Gaonim, the word yeshiva has a very unique meaning. There are yeshivot and there are batei midrash. What's the difference? The difference is very, very significant. A base matters is a place you put it, you buy the books, and you have tables, and you have standards, and you have a coffee machine, and then you get an ark, and and you learn, and you put yourself into business, okay? A yeshiva is something totally different. It's not like what we call yeshiva today is the same as batei midrash, except maybe writ large. In the Gaonic period, a yeshiva is an ecumenical central institution of which there are maybe one, two, or three. In fact, from the year 550 until, let's say, the 11th century, there are exactly three yeshivot in the world. Two in Babylonia and one in Eretz Israel. A yeshiva is a worldwide institution which encompasses and draws Jews from all over the world. Okay. Not anybody just opens the base. A yeshiva. Yeshiva is, I don't know what to call it. Well, we'll see in a second. That sense of the word yeshiva is not used anymore. There was one last attempt to revive it 100 years ago. On Rehov Rav Tzvi Yehuda in Kiryat Moshe, there's a big building, and it's called Merkaz Harav. Anybody know what the official name of that yeshiva is? That's not the official name of the yeshiva. We call it Merkaz, but it's not. Nobody knows? Next time you go down Rehov Rav Tzvi Yehuda, take a look. It says HaYeshiva HaOlamit. The universal yeshiva of Kook, Zatzal, wanted to revive, his hope was that Merkaz HaRav would be the central yeshiva for the entire Jewish world and would serve as the spiritual center for what he hoped to be the spiritual and Torah and Jewish renaissance, which would come as part of the return to Eretz Israel. Okay. That's the last hurrah of this sense of what it means to be yeshiva. In any event, this idea of the uniqueness biladiyut, the exclusive uniqueness of the yeshivot in Baghdad, is expressed beautifully in a letter by Rav Shrira Gaon. Rav Shrira Gaon lived at the end of the period of the Gaon. He was the father of Rav Hai. He lived a long life. He lived to be 100 years old. He lived from 906 to 1006. And he writes the following, and he lived in a time of something of that was very troubled politically. What happened was that in the middle of the 10th century, it's towards the end of the period, but it says a lot about what they thought about themselves throughout the entire time. In the middle of the century, there was a rebellion against the central government in Egypt and North Africa. Okay, I'll go into the details. That meant that the western part of the, if you imagine the Mediterranean, a map of the Mediterranean in your head, that means that the western areas, Spain, North Africa, were cut off from the center, and the Gaonim were out of touch. I mean, you couldn't get there. There was no internet. There was a very, very effective mail system, and everything we know about the Gaonim has reached us because of the mails, because people sent
they sent letters and to and shuvas and Jerushim and all kinds of stuff in the mail to all kinds of places, and these were preserved and reached us, or they were cited by other Rishonim. But when there's a war, the first thing to go is mail, communication in general. When the war ended, or when the situation was stabilized, the Gaonim tried to restore their contact or their connections with the Western communities. They wanted to restore their authority. They wanted to restore their educational connections with the communities in the West, in Spain and North Africa, and also, how do we put this delicately, when people would send questions to the Gaonim, they also sent checks, money, whatever, donations, free will donations, self-stamped envelopes, whatever was necessary. Okay, so as part of the effort to restore the connections and to strengthen the connection between the yeshivot in Bavel and North Africa, he writes the following letter, apparently to Kairouan. Kairouan is a major city in North Africa. The most famous two residents of Kairouan were Rabbeinu Hananel and Rav Nissen Gaon. He was a Gaon, but he wasn't a Gaon. That is, he was a genius, but he wasn't officially a Gaon. In fact, there is some discussion or some confusion as to what it means, the period of the Gaonim. We know the word Gaon means genius. However, that's not what the mean word means in our period. The word Gaon is actually an abbreviation for the formal title of the yeshiva head, which is Rosh Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov. The head of the yeshiva, which is the pride, Gaon, of Jacob. And so they're called Gaonim. I mean, some of them were Gaonim and some of them were not such big Gaonim. But the point is that's why they're called Gaonim. In any event, so Rav Shmira Gaon writes to Kairouan as follows. Okay? He says, I want you to please start sending us letters, ask us questions, ask us for our interpretations of the Talmud, ask us to restore restore our relationship of teaching and spreading the only authoritative interpretation of the Gemara that exists. He says, because by your not doing it, now look at Pai in the first line, you are destroying this place. First line, a little bit of Jewish joke. By being silent towards it. By abandoning it. From the time that your parents, this is a two-generation business, from the time of your fathers, so we're silent to us, or they ignored us and stopped talking to us. We started suffering from want. And things are getting increasingly bad. Year after year, it gets worse and worse. And if you restore the relationship that we had, we will thereby save you from punishment because you're hurting the Torah. The Torah only exists here. Take a few, you'll see how to what degree they saw this to be true. Mina onish kiyocheach et avotenu asher mizkir and so on. Skip a little bit to this line. See where there's like a wider break? It's because I didn't cut and paste so much. And if you say in your hearts, that you're going to keep the things the way they are now, say, you know what? We didn't hear from you for two generations. We had to learn how to be on our own. We had to try to figure out Gemaras and Paskin on our own. So you know what? We found out that there were smart people that live in North Africa too. And there were big Talmidei Chachamim who could grow in here too. Who needs you? Who do you need? You know, it's all about kol kavod. We have all the, we give you all the respect in the world, but total dependence is not that important to us. Ki tisharun al matontechem, velo yishchachtun midrashchem. He says, and as a result, we don't want to undermine the status of our yeshivas, what we would call today our midrashim. You know, I mean, we'll talk to you sometimes, but we're not going to go back to a situation of total dependence. He says, how can you do that? As a result, ha-yeshiva is nishchetet. Ha-yeshiva. The same kind of thing I was talking about. Ha-yeshiva nishchetet. The yeshiva is being destroyed. How can you do that? Halo reshechem hema. The heads of the yeshiva are your heads. They're your leaders. As it says, reshechem shiftechem. The eich yishachet harosh. How is it possible for the head to become corrupted, the yishlam haguf, and the body to be, remain whole? Vacharei harosh haguf holech. That tells you everything about how the Gaonim saw themselves as part of a Torah hierarchy. We are very, very much not used to the idea. Of a rabbinic hierarchy. Ashkenazim especially, who as we'll see later on when we talk about Mosarit Ashkenaz, there's an anarchistic like element in Ashkenaz. We don't like chief rabbis, and we don't like chief anything. And we like Balagan, okay? But that's not the position of the Gaonim. The position of the Gaonim is there's one Torah, there's one yeshiva or two yeshivas, there's one center, there's one truth. We're the head, you're the body. Poshut. Hakitzu na'achinu. Wake up, my brother, our brothers. V'habitu be'ele. Look at what you have here in Bavel. V'simu kavod la'shem elokeichem l'tarato l'chachamecha. U'lechu b'minhag avotechem. U'v'dore chorechem. Restore or walk in the ways of your ancestors. V'chziru et davar li'yoshno. Restore the circumstance, the situation to what it was previously. V'agidu l'anusvoto svechotechem. Tell us your doubts. Now, this is not just a power play. It's something even deeper. There is nothing more miserable. There is no greater suffering than a teacher who doesn't have the opportunity to teach. The Rambam writes in Mor Nevuchim that he quotes a pasuk from Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu says he tried to keep his nevuahs within himself and he couldn't keep it. It was like fire in his midst. The Rambam says that's exactly the way a teacher has to be. It's not just a matter of the Gaonim are just saying, you know, we give us back our covet. They're saying, no, we have the authentic Masorah. It physically hurts us not to share it. Send us your questions. Leman tiruna tetshuvot. So you'll see our answers. Vidboninuba. There's a mistake in the manuscript. And you'll understand them. Vigam yechazak, and as a result also, by the way, yechazak lev chachmei yeshiva, the rabbis who are living here in the yeshiva, they'll become courage. Birotam ki atem ponim aleihem. That you're willing to support them. By the way, this also means that in yeshiva in Bavel, what? The rabbis took salaries. They were being supported. There were professional rabbanim who were living, being supported as part of the faculty of the yeshiva. Now that might sound, that's exactly the case. The answer is no. In Ashkenaz, nobody took a grush, or most people didn't take a grush for Torah. They were all business people. In Spain, the practice was that Rabbanim and Rosh Yeshiva were paid. And who was the greatest critic of this system? The Rambam. Okay? The Rambam's opposition to taking money for Torah is a direct reaction to the fact that it was the established precedent was that the Gaon would take the money for Torah. There's a huge machlokes. If you look at the Rambam in Hilchos Talmud Torah, where the Rambam sits there and says all kinds of terrible things about people to take salaries if they're Rabbanim. And then you take a look at the Machaber, the Kesef Mishnah, where he talks about, you know, tries to justify the practice. You can see the kinds of tension around this issue. Okay? In any case, you should know something. This is important. This is part of the punchline. Ude'u ki lo lichvodenu, ve lo lichvod beit avinu, dibarno alechem kashot keile. We're not ranking you out. We're not giving you Musar. Stamka. Ki lechvod Hashem. We're doing this for the honor of God. This is the yeshiva that was founded by Rav. Rav studied with who? Rav Yehuda Nosi. So our yeshiva embodies, once you make the jump to Rav Yehuda Nosi, Ish Mipi, Ish Mipi. What's the end of the path, what's the sentence? Moshe Rabbeinu. Active Masorah means an active living chain of transmission from Sinai to now. Rabbanit Lichtenstein once noted, talked about it, mentioned that her father, Kod Mori Varavi, Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal, once mentioned that he, I don't know how back this goes, that he knew a guy, or he met a guy, who met a guy, he saw somebody who saw somebody who saw the Vilna Gaon. So this is, the sense of imminent Masorah is a very, very powerful, that's the essence of, that's when we talk about Masorah all the time, it's a much abused word nowadays. But that's what that means. That you have a tangible and tactile almost connection to Sinai. And that's what he's saying. This is it. He says, Lo she'edim, ulechvot torato, leman lo yovdun arba amoteha, ki afilu ravta torah habe me'od bimkomot achirim, ve'ulam arba amot shel halacha, hinei heima. Here comes the punchline. Vezot hatzura. This institution which we represent, who bimkom, what's the word? Sanhedrin. Uverosha, who bimkom, what's it say? Moshe Rabbeinu. It's a very, very different, and they don't mean like every Rosh Yeshiva, okay, is an heir of Moshe Rabbeinu. But that's not what I'm saying here. This is Ish. If you want the MS, it's here. Exclusively here. Now, that's not just propaganda. And that's just an attempt to advance a quality institution. This position has absolutely mind-boggling halachic implication. Number one. There's an assumption that there's only one answer, generally, to any question or to any gemara. This is one assumption. It's number one. Number two, all institutions are subordinate to the central one. Just as there's only one Bezdin HaGadol B'Yerushalayim, there's only one, or two in this case, yeshivas in Bavel, and everybody else is subordinate. Number three, the Rosh, in the fourth parak in Sanhedrin, records a pretty extensive machlokas between the Ravid and the Balamor and himself, and this actually finds its expression elsewhere as well. Do the Gaonim have a leg up? Do they have extra authority? Do their words and their tshuvas have more authority than things that were said by other Rishonim? Or not? This becomes a very major halachic Rishon. So, for example, the Bala Morse, what is it based? It's based on the following contention. On the contention of the Gaonim, that the living embodiment of the Torah Shebal Peh continues in the yeshivas, so that even though the Gemara is finished, the Gemara is sealed, still, the yeshivot from which the Gemara emerged have a special status. Now, why should or why shouldn't it? I have to go to a Gemara in Bava Metzia. The Gemara in Bava Metzia says, Ravina Ravashi Tzofara. That at the time of Ravina and Ravashi, around 500, maybe the Talmidim is 400, whatever it was, by 550, something significant ended or changed in history of Shabbat. What changed is, can probably be described as follows. With the conclusion of, and this is what the Rambam says in Hakdamah to the Perish of Mishnayis, he says in Hakdamah to the Mishnah Torah, with the conclusion of the Gemara is promulgated as, what should we call it, the constitution of Judaism. In other words, it becomes a closed corpus. I mean, it's not a constitution, it's impossible to actually to characterize, or very hard to characterize. It becomes the corpus out of which all Torah Shebal Peh has to emerge, but it's closed. What does it mean it's closed? It means that the way that people will come afterwards learn Torah Shebal Peh and apply Torah Shebal Peh and relate to the people who came before them is fundamentally different. Up until Ravina and Ravashi, or Mava Ravashi, or the last generations of Amoraim, okay, more or less, all of the Chachamim are playing on a level playing field. They're all part of the same ongoing, from the inside, development, interpretation, expansion, analysis of the qualities and the terms of the Torah Shebal Peh. And in fact, in theory, let's go with an extreme formulation. In theory, everybody can disagree with everybody else. Now, we all know that a Mohr is not allowed to disagree with a Tana, and that's an ironclad rule of Psak, and a Bichlal of the way the arguments in the Gemara go. That's true. But the Mechaber says in Kesef Mishnah, the second parak in Mamrim, he says that was not inherent and it was not required. In other words, in principle, later generations are allowed to disagree with earlier ones. However, the Amorayim accepted upon themselves, sort of as an act of deference to the Tanoim, that they would not disagree with a Tana, or they would not express an opinion unless they could find a Tana de Masayeya, a Tana who would agree with them. And if they don't, if their opinion was such that there's no Tana who could possibly support or line up with their opinion, then we reject their opinion as saying what? What's the word? Tiyufta. But says the Mechaber, that's not inherent. That was an act of deference and kavod Torah from the Amorayim on the part of the Tanoim. And in fact, there's not a few places where Amorayim actually come up with shitas which have no Tanaitic support. But in principle, they're all on the same playing field. And in fact, there's a preference that's given for later opinions even over earlier ones. No question of whether you read out to the road, the generations get better or worse, but that's a whole other story. But in general, Mishnah Achrona, Mishnah Rishona, we take Mishnah Achrona. With the arrival, with the conclusion of the activity of Ravashi and Ravina and Marva Ravashi and Puri, bring the whole thing together, a chasm opens up. A chasm opens up, and at that point, Bali and Masora no longer are equal participants in the study, in the dialogue, in the discourse of Torah. But the Gemara becomes a text to be interpreted. You're no longer participating, you're interpreted. In other words, you're taking a big one step further, and the totality of the Gemara becomes my point of departure. And, by definition, you're not allowed to disagree with the Gemara. Ever. The Gaonim accept this. The Gaonim accept this. That, in fact, something very, very significant has happened. And we are now subordinate to the Gemara. We're not participating in the discussion that way. And hence, one could easily make the argument, just like Rambam does and all kinds of other Rishonim, that, yeah, okay. So the Gaonim, they're very nice, but they basically are also living in a different era, and they're doing things which are different than what the Amorayim and the Tanayim do. They're not creating halachas out of psukim and all kinds of other things. Only they're allowed to do that. And since essentially we all do the same thing, there's no difference between the Gaonim and us. To the extent where the Rambam drives this home in the Hakdamah to the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam says that all the Chachamim who lived after Ravino and Ravashi, they're called Gaonim. Doesn't matter where they lived. In France, in Germany, in North Africa, in Spain, they're all called Gaonim. What does the Rambam mean to say? Rambam says, it's not special about the Gaonim. I mean, yeah, they had Masorot, they have a lot of covet, whatever, but qualitatively, the major sea change is with the activities of Ravina Ravashi. When Torah Sheval Peh goes from being an active, ongoing expansion from the inside to an activity of interpretation and application and an analysis of a text. The fact that people who lived not in Babel have a title of Gaon is sort of a quiet expression of the same idea. I mentioned Rav Nissim Gaon. The reason I came to this is because, why they call him Rav Nissim Gaon? He wasn't a Gaon. I mean, Why was he called Gaon? Because again, there was a sense that the Gaonim are doing something just like we're doing, except maybe they have a bigger establishment. That's one sheet. That's the sheet of the Balamor and more or less the sheet of the Rush. The Ravid in the fourth parak in the Rush cited in the Rush in the fourth parak in Sanhedrin says no, the Gaonim are special status. Their opinions have more weight. But if they're doing everything the same thing we're doing, which is interpreting a Gemara, what's the difference? The answer is this letter. Because the embodiment of the living tradition of Torah Sheval Peh was still extant, at least up to 1038, in the yeshiva. They had masoros of parshanut and other things which nobody else had. And therefore, their words have more cachet. They have more authority. So, in other words, this self-definition of the Gaonim, that they're it, that they're Bimkom HaSanhedrin V'Roshah, is Bimkom Rosh Rabbeinu, is responsible. That's the point of contention, is Machlokes Rishonim, whether Gaonim have special status or not. By the way, Dafka, it's interesting. Dafka among Ashkenazim there's all kinds of little places where this finds expression. The best example, I think, is if you can Tosfos, the major Sefer Halacha that comes out of the world of the Gaonim is the Halachas Gedolos, which wasn't written actually by one of the Gaonim. It was written by a man named Rav Shimon Kayara, apparently, who lived in Basra, which is in south of Baghdad. But it was a tremendous amount of authority was attributed to it, and Tosfos always say Kishakol Dvarav Divrei Kabbalah. What does it mean? Told Dvarav Divrei Kabbalah. We accept it blindly. If you have a Kabbalah, you don't ask where it comes from. It's a Kabbalah. In a Kabbalah, in a Kabbalah. Tradition for us, this is very anti-modern, very not cool for the. In contemporary cultural discourse. But for us, a Masoret or a Kabbalah is a very, very, very serious thing, because it's weighted with the hoary authority of tradition. So, that's as far as how the Gaonim saw themselves
And they took this responsibility very, very seriously. Up until the 10th century, all the Gaonim did, all the heads of the yeshivas did, was to teach Torah and to answer questions that were sent from all over the world. And in fact, people came from all over the world to study in the yeshivot in Babel. From Italy and from Spain and from North Africa, from all over the world. There was this idea that you come and you study with Gaonei Bavel. One of the things the Gaonim didn't do, by the way, is, and it's striking that they didn't, is that they never, I hope I have this here. Yeah. Is that they didn't write full Perushim of the Gemara. Who wrote the first made the first full attempt at writing a parish on the Gemara? Who? Well, Rabbeinu Hananel and Rabbeinu Geshem, the two of them. Okay? The first one to really do it successfully was Rashi. So the question is, wait a minute. If the Gaonim had the real Masorah, they had all kinds of traditions about what the Amoraim meant and what the Gersot of the Gemara were. And, I mean, that's where it happened. There's lots of stuff we know that the Gaonim and the Tshuvas write that we have a tradition of this, this, and this, and this. The Rav Ashi and Ravina didn't put in the Gemara. So how come they didn't write a parish? Why didn't they share? So you could say, if you want to be cynical, you'd say, they wanted to have a monopoly. But why have a monopoly? The nature of Torah is to teach it. So for this, you have a, take a look on, which page is this? 1, 2, 3, 4. Page 4 at the top. This is a famous tshuva of Rav Sar Shalom Gaon, who was the Gaon of Sura for 10 years from 843 to 853. If you want to put this into context, he was writing tshuvas and sort of leading world Jewry at a time that the Vikings were busy burning down all of Western Europe. You know the famous story about the Israeli? The Israeli came from a Sephardic family, and he was a British politician. He was Meshumet. He converted to Anglican Christianity as a way of getting ahead. But anyway, so he was attacked in Parliament once as why should I know you're a Jew? It shows you how effective conversion can be. Anyway, so this famous story that he replied when this other member of parliament called him a Jew, he said when the learned gentlemen or the respected honorable gentlemen's ancestors were painting their bodies blue and living in the forests, mine were Levites singing in the temple of Solomon. And the other gears, of course, it's two gears. The other gears is that my ancestors were at Mount Sinai. But in this case, it's true. All this stuff is happening, and all this beautiful, all this incredible civilization is being developed by the Gaonim in Baghdad, and the much touted Christians are busy having their world destroyed by Vikings. Okay. Anyway, Rav Sar Shalom Gaon gets the following question. Sar Shalom Bishar Amo. He has the Rav Sar Shalom is writing an answer to the following question. Goy sheichnis yado betoch yino shel Yisrael. What happens if a guy sticks his hand into a barrel of wine of a Jew, okay, and doesn't move? Let's assume it's hard to know what he meant, but say he didn't move. In other words, he didn't move around. In order to answer for Yei Nesech, you really need to, you have to really move your finger around. In fact, there are plenty of Gemaras in Avodah Zarah where the guy puts his hand in and somebody grabs his hand, don't move your finger, so you don't answer the wine. Okay, and then, so then he asked the question with regard to that. Anybody learn the last, they learned Masechta Avodah Zarah? This is a very, very complicated business. Okay, so what are the dinim if a guy touches the wine of a Jew? Says Rav Sar Shalom Gaon, Kulam Mesubachot Zov V'Zov Da. This is a really complicated business. And they're really dark. In other words, it's really hard to penetrate to understand how to make seder, how to make order in these, how to organize all of the various variations and different permutations of this law. The truth of the matter is, he writes, the im hayaratzon, if things were really the right way, if God had really willed it, the hayitim lefaneinu, and you were here in Baghdad with us. Hayayef shar lefarshan yafeh yafeh. We could really sit down with the sugyas and learn and explain them, explore them, and elucidate the sugyas properly, as is appropriate. Ulevavaran yafeh yafeh, and to clarify them properly. Zomizo, and all the various, permutations. Kamud davar dibor alafanav, each statement or each issue, carefully characterized and categorized and defined, and it sounds very brisker, but that's what he says. Okay, so that would be that's the optimal situation. He says, "Mipnei shekisha talmid yoshev b'fnei rabba." The student sits in front of his master. V'yitzav v'yitem b'varaloch, and they're learning. They're talking. They're speaking and learning, or they're discussing it with some issue. Yodea rabbo, the master, the teacher, can know the ezet sadli bonotet. He can see where the discussion's going. Does he understand? Does he not understand? He can correct his mistakes. He can guide his thinking in the proper direction. He can impart to him the proper methodology. We can also intuit, or he can tell from the way he's speaking what he doesn't understand or what pieces of information he's missing in order to be able to properly interpret whatever Gemara or whatever issue is in front of him. Umamit barerlo, and what does understand. Umamit kakeshalav, what he finds difficult. Uposhe, and at that point, the Rebbe, he knows what he knows, what he doesn't know, where he has trouble, where he needs help, where he doesn't need help. With all of that in mind, uposheitlo, and he can explain things, make things up, simplify everything, lay it out for the student, ad shemit yir enav, until, the student understands. Umarelo panim bahalacha, he shows him exactly how the din should come out. Aval, bichtav, in writing. Kamef Sharlo, how much can you do? On the contrary, study by correspondence is a recipe for misunderstanding. It's a recipe for error. And everybody knows that if you take the wrong right turn, even if you continue following this before ways, if you take the wrong right turn and you keep driving, you're just going to get further and further and further from where you're supposed to, where you originally intended to go. He says, I'm writing to you the best I can, but this is far from ideal, because study which is not frontal, study which is not face-to-face, study which is not oral, is by definition inferior and fraught with error. In a word, the reason why the Gaonim didn't write global perushim to the Gemara, quality control. Quality control. Now, there is an assumption here also, I think, that any given sugya has one proper interpretation. And this speaks actually to something the Rambam writes in the Mor Nevuchim. Rambam the Mor Nevuchim says that oral study is always better. Studying from a Rebbe is always better. Study face-to-face with a Chavrus is always better. Because it avoids error. The worst thing in the world, said the Rambam, is the fact that the Gemara was written down and people could try to learn on their own, because that led to machlokas. And in the world of the Gaonim, unity and uniformity are good things. Pluralism, multiplicity of opinions, are bad. Machloket is bad. Ay, elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. That's true. But that's a situation with which we have to make peace. It's not optimal. Ashkenazim say, this is based on a Ritva in the Ervin, elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, there's machloket in heaven, so why? There's machloket in heaven already. Like the Ritva quotes a medrash which Chachmei Ashkenaz loved to quote, where Moshe Rabbeinu goes up to heaven and there's a machla on every single shaila. There were 49 sides to every single argument, this way or that way, and he sees the angels are fighting in the yeshiva shomal, and they're all screaming and yelling and carrying on, and Moshe Rabbeinu, what am I supposed to do with this? So according to the medrash, God says to Moshe Rabbeinu, it's fine, anything you say will be fine. Dor v'dor sham, dor v'dor l'sofram, al pi ha'davar sher yerucha, I'm giving it over to you. But it means the machlokas is already in heaven. That's not the sheet of the Geonim. Sheet of the Geonim is you sit there and you carefully avoid machlokas as much as possible. Who wrote all the Sifrei Halacha in the history of Halacha, in the history of Torah? Sfardim. The Rif. The Rambam. For our purposes, the Tur. Even though he's Ashkenazi, for our purposes, it's Sephardi, and Rabbi Yosef Karo. There's a reason for that. Because there's this tradition that goes all the way back to the Geonim, that there's one halacha, one Torah, more than one Torah, more than one day is a very bad thing. Ashkenazim like anarchy. We'll get to that. In any event, so on the one hand, the Geonim, argued that they had a monopoly on exclusivity on the Bavli, and you have to come and study with us in order to be able to have it. The other side of that is that they kept it to themselves as part of quality control. Lest there be machlokas. Machlokas is not a good thing. That's a shita. It's not just a tactic. And they held by their word. Okay. Next week, Mirza Shem, Rabbi Liebtag has threatened that he's going to land and come straight here and take my class away. But in case he doesn't, we will go through a description of how the yeshiva of the Geonim worked, how people. Came from all over the world, and how the studies were undertaken, and what their derech and learning was, and with that we will continue the discussion.